Okay, so today I would be, as you already know, talking, I guess, briefly about the planning graph heuristics for belief-based search. You already read this, so you have several of you have also put comments. I read, I think, all but the last three, because the last three were left, you know, added in the last, when after I looked at it, I guess, at 1:30 or something. But this is good. I think we'll hopefully do this more as the semester progresses. And I actually like it in one place instead of 10 different places that I have to click. You know, there's one little page. So I think I'm increasingly losing the hope that you will actually maintain notes. But I guess at least this way we'll use the wiki since I spent time setting it up. But I think there are some things that we will talk today, some of the comments that I noticed. For next class, we will be doing MDPs, which is again dropped down to atomic level. I set up the slides for it. I mean, my eternally optimistic view is that we might actually start talking about MDPs today itself. It's good to have optimism. But if not, next class, and you should look at the slides before coming. And I know that several of you probably already know methodization processes from 471. I'm going to use separate set of slides just so that at least you will have something else to look into. But it would be mostly getting up to the value and policy iteration of methodization processes. And as I mentioned in that huge paper, you should read up to the section that I suggested. Okay, and then when I come back, if I come back from Greece, then we will talk about one of two things. Actually, either I haven't yet made up my mind, but either so once we do MDPs, we can directly do PomDPs, which are partially observable methodization processes. That means belief space. Belief state uncertainty thrown on top of the stochastic outcomes, okay, but at the atomic level. That's one topic that would come next. And the other topic is, of course, PomDPs, and the other topic, of course, is factored planners for stochastic planning. So, propositional planners for stochastic planning. So that basically means, just as we did belief search planners after we did belief search state space search, we would do this. Most likely, even as I'm speaking, I think it'll be easier for us to do this and then go to PomDPs and then talk about PomDPs methods for handling PomDPs in the propositional approaches. As we get to PomDPs and the methods for handling them in propositional approaches, we are basically touching whatever little we know, I mean, you know, towards the edge of our understanding right now. There are very few efficient algorithms for PomDPs as of now. Okay. And PomDPs are also much more intensely mathematical compared to even MDPs. If you have looked at our chapter, I don't know, did any of you find the MDPs chapter particularly hard to read? For those of you who, if you did find that paper hard to read, then you'll have more fun reading PomDPs, because there in essence actually each belief state itself is a distribution, and you are searching in the space of distribution. And again, when we first talk about PomDPs, we talk about optimality guarantees for finding optimal PomDP policies. And the nice part is we can easily find optimal policies for PomDPs as long as the number of states is around 20. Okay, 20 states. So log of 20 is the number of state variables we are talking about. Okay, beyond that, it's all up for grabs. Okay, so these things actually raise very quickly in complexity. But one of the reasons to think about MDPs and PomDPs, and I'll mention this again when we get there, is they provide the best normative models for understanding what is a solution supposed to do. Okay, you can generate a solution in any which way, but you need some way of figuring out, is that the best that you can do? And you know, PALM DPs and MDPs provide you the normative baseline. Okay, you may never reach it, but it's great to have there. Okay, and many a time when we are doing propositional stochastic planners, many of them are approximate, so they try to approximate the optimal policy for, let's say, MDPs. And if they're very good papers, they will try to give bounds as to how far can they be from the optimum. Okay, so that's basically the reason to look at it. Anyway, so most likely I will get you papers for this, which will come directly after MDPs, and then after that we came to PALM DPs. Okay, that's where we're going. So I just thought this was interesting. I keep talking in the class, and you know, I have no clue whether you're understanding stuff or not. And since we don't have weekly quizzes, it's even harder to tell. Here is one, I guess, the most recent evaluation of my lecturing style. This is stuff that I was trying to teach my son the other day. Actually, not the other day, a while back. You know, this is our kitchen whiteboard. And I thought it was going very well. And then over the weekend, he bought a Farsight cartoon book only because it contained that particular cartoon. I'll let you read it. But I hope you are getting more than that. Okay. So we will be doing heuristics for belief space planning. And I understand that one of the things that, I'm not sure whether the first time whether I should name names, but some of the first, I guess, first nine reviews I read, some were more critical than others. And I think you need to be critical. Okay, I understand this is the first time, and you know, some of you have said we can't see there's any flaw there. Okay, but everything put in LaTeX looks good. Okay, and you know, especially if it's been published beforehand, you know, it's even more intimidating. Especially if the instructor of the class is one of the co-authors, you are probably wondering whether you want to say anything bad about it. Right, but you know, notwithstanding all that, I think you should try to be as critical as possible. Even if you are wrongly critical, that beats the heck out of just being blindly accepting. Okay, the next idea comes because you think the current stuff is broken. If you are happy, then you know, you go do something else, you know, undergraduate course in some other area. Okay, so basically look for specific problems. And I thought overall, I mean, I didn't expect too much for the first set of reviews. I thought this was pretty good. Okay, I'll try to give some comments. You know, I only read these. I think they were only ready, most of them, like today, because I think the last time I checked, there was nothing there yet, which is okay. But I'll give you some comments this time. But, you know, the next time onwards, we'll probably have shorter papers. In fact, when I come back, we'll probably read one or two papers on propositional stochastic planning. And you need to write comments on those too. And then try to look for what are the ways the thing is not exactly doing what it is claiming to do. Okay, or what else? It's like, since you are writing the paper, you can always, I mean, if you are writing the paper, you'll always make sure that the limitations are not shown very clearly, right? And it may be partly because you want the paper to get in, and partly also because you don't realize it. You know, if you're working on certain, a particular topic for long enough time, you think what you're doing is right. Okay, so you always want to look for what's wrong. I think skepticism is extremely important. Yes, sir.
One thing is like one comment that I read was that basically this paper does not take into account the online updation of the plan as well as the static. Is that not in the scope of the paper, or is
So for this particular paper, actually some of the easy ones are already been done. Okay, so for example, if you are talking about online, then essentially the issue, one issue for example, is why not do one action and then see what the world does and do a next action. Okay, and in fact we will read a paper, I can go ahead and tell you, thankfully only a 7-page paper this time for the next one, that for the MDPs part called FF Hop, which is one thing. Again, I happen to be a co-author on this. The reason I pick those is because I know them. We will read other papers too, but this one winds up doing online search, online heuristic approaches for stochastic planning. Okay, and when we talk about FF Hop, one very interesting question to ask yourself is, how does this paper relate to that? I mean, can you use some of the ideas of heuristics in that? I mean, if you remember, remind me, and I have some ideas I can mention at that point of time. Okay, there was one more point that people made, I think, about why isn't this being used for stochastic planning. Again, that too has been done. There is another paper on this, you know, by Dan, on what he calls sequential Monte Carlo algorithms, Monte Carlo heuristics. And basically, what he winds up doing there is, is that if you have stochastic actions, you have multiple possible outcomes, right? Okay, so what you could do is you sample the outcomes of the actions. You get a deterministic problem. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you sample the outcomes of the actions, then you'll get a deterministic problem. For that deterministic problem, you can then generate a labeled uncertainty graph.
So doesn't he apply this principle on this paper somewhere?
He does not directly, because there's no probabilities in this. This is basically the next paper that's, you know, sequential Monte Carlo heuristics is just stone's throw from this paper. I mean, again, the technical details are somewhat involved, but understanding it at an intuitive level, what you'll wind up doing is that each determinization for a stochastic planning problem corresponds to a deterministic planning graph. So that two things you're doing. You're starting with a stochastic problem, and you do what's called determinization, and this is a word you will keep you hearing more starting after next class. Determinization essentially means if you have an action which has probabilistic outcomes, you can sample it, toss a coin, and see what outcome actually occurs. That's different from just taking the most likely outcome. If you take most likely outcome, that's just one single determinization. You know, it's like the most likely outcome determination. If in fact this action says, I'll give you P with 0.7 probability and Q with 0.3 probability, then you get a coin which comes heads 0.7, probability and tails 0.3 probability, and actually toss it. When you toss it, then it will basically say, okay, depending on how that thing came, in fact, it could say that Q is what you got on this toss. Even though it's an unlikely one, it can happen because it's a sampling. Okay, more often you will get the P samples, sometimes you get the Q samples. Okay, if you have basically sampled all the actions once, then you got a determinization. That's a deterministic planning problem at this point. So you can generate, so now you can solve the deterministic planning problems directly. That's one idea, which is what you'd wind up doing in this paper that you will read, F of Hop, because it's easy enough to solve deterministic planning problems. Another idea that you can do is, well, when you are in deterministic planning, you thought that was hard enough. That's why you looked for heuristics. Right? And so you could essentially say, for every deterministic planning problem, I'll compute a relaxed planning graph. And then I union all those relaxed planning graphs to compute essentially a heuristic estimate for this ensemble of deterministic planning problems. And that is approximately what the generalization of this paper does, and a different paper called Sequential Monte Carlo Heuristic, LUG. So Monte Carlo LUG is finding the heuristic estimate over an ensemble of planning problems. FF Hop approach, we will see, just goes ahead and solves them. And which is better, I don't know, because nobody actually has figured out, you know, empirically which, you know, performs better. So that's one connection between these labeled uncertainty graphs from Dan's work and you know, the stuff that we'll be doing again at the stochastic level.
Let me ask you a question. Three messages, they're laid out.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long thing. Okay.
Perform meaning what in terms of? No, so when you talk about heuristics, you have to talk about three different things, right? Two different things at least. One is the cost you spend computing that heuristic. And second is how good is the search with respect to that heuristic. To understand how good a search is with respect to heuristic, you go back to your 471 ideas and start talking about informedness and admissibility. Okay. The two things that are very close in the paper that you read is multiple planning graph heuristics and LUG. And they're very close, and that's by design. Because LUG essentially tries to estimate what the multiple planning graph heuristic would do without doing as much work. Okay, and now multiple planning graph heuristic is actually trying to estimate H star, and it fails at that. Okay, so this guy is aiming for H star, this guy is aiming for this guy. Did you understand what I'm saying? That's basically what happened. If you can get H star, you don't need search. You know, you just go directly. All heuristics are trying to aim for H star, which is the actual cost of reaching the goal state from the current state. Okay. And they, you know, approximate in different ways. Okay, and you know, the multiple planning graph one is quite a reasonable idea. It ignores negative interactions, it keeps the positive interactions alone, and tries to estimate as close as it can get. Basically, it makes an estimate of the cost. Okay, the problem with that, the only problem with that is that it's pretty costly. I mean, even though you're computing relaxed plans, you're doing it for multiple number of words, right? And so what you wind up having to do is somehow, and then all those words wind up having a lot of repetition. I'll show you a couple of slides where this kind of becomes cleaner. And you want to avoid repetitive work. So all LUG is doing is trying to get as far as this guy gets, but much faster. Okay, and so normally when you look at the results, what you would see is you will see a huge number of timeouts for this guy. Because where it falls, it is giving you good estimates. I mean, as good an estimate as this. But it takes too long to compute the heuristic. And you remember that the heuristic is being called at each state in the progression. So if the heuristic takes a long time, then you know you might be quite inefficient. I mean, you basically run out of time. Okay. Now, of course, interestingly, since neither of these turn out to be admissible, I mean, it should be obvious that multiple planning graph heuristics are not admissible. Why aren't they admissible?
Because they add
everything up.
So they
overestimate.
Because they add.
Yeah. That's the reason for admissibility, loss of admissibility. Why aren't they particularly informed? So, if H star, remember the pictures we used to have? In 471, if H star is this, right? If H star is this, and remember why H star should touch X axis? What?
Goal state.
If it's a heuristic, at the goal state it should say the distance is zero. So it should touch, you know, X axis at least some point. So of course, I mean, these are the search nodes, search states. And this is the value. And I drew these kind of things multiple times in 471, right? Okay, so we know that multiple planning graph heuristic, whatever it is, might sometimes cross. That's why, you know, because you're adding up, for example. You are avoiding cutting. In fact, one of the interesting things is multiple planning graph heuristic, you do avoid, I mean, part of the reason you do that is you avoid multi-counting. Okay, but then one of you said this, that alignment has to be done correctly to avoid multi-counting. And in the paper, basically, we just, I mean, Dan uses just a reasonable approach for aligning sequences.
Order them.
What?
You could order them for alignment.
You could?
Order them lexicographically or something.
Yeah, that's not, no, the problem is that one of the plans might actually be non-minimal, so it would wind up having irrelevant actions in the middle, and because of which the alignment gets, you know, goes out. Okay. Now, by the way, so it looks the way I think you said, if you the reason it crosses is because you add up. Suppose I don't add. Suppose I take max. So I compute multiple planning graphs, relaxed plans, take just the max of the relaxed plans. Would it be admissible then? No. So, because there are, you know, again, the, keeping track of the levels of approximations you do in these things is interesting in itself. If you remember, relaxed plans are essentially greedily finding a plan from the final, you know, from the goal state to the initial state. Finding an optimal relaxed plan is the only one that will guarantee you admissibility. Okay, and since you don't do it, since nobody in there, you know, other than, unless you are like crazy about probable optimality, nobody does actual optimal relaxed plans. So finding optimal relaxed plans is NP-hard. So this is the interesting thing. This is true for classical planning too. So even if you didn't have belief space planning, even if you just had STRIPS planning, okay, in STRIPS planning, finding a plan is NP-hard if the plan length happens to be polynomial. But under the STRIPS action representation, you can easily represent problems which require exponential length plans. A classic example is Tower of Hanoi. Okay, you can write Tower of Hanoi as a simple STRIPS planning problem, which essentially means that in that case, just checking that you have the correct plan will take exponential time. It's no longer in the class NP anymore. You know, NP class is, if I give you a solution, you can check whether it is a solution or not in polynomial time. So non-deterministic polynomial, if you generate all of them in parallel, if you have the biggest parallel machine out there, then each of them being simultaneously checked for solutionness, and the solution check takes polynomial time, you'll be done in polynomial time. That's the NP definition, right? Now, since you have, if you allow exponential length solution domains, which are allowed if you have normal STRIPS actions, then it's no longer NP-hard, it becomes higher, it's called p-space complete. Now, if you take any such problem, whether it's NP-hard or p-space complete, right, and if you say, I'll ignore all the delete, and I'll ignore all the negative interactions, so that I'm solving an abstraction of the problem, which is of no use, really, because, you know, when I try to do it in the world, I'll fail, because there will be negative interactions. But if I want to find the optimal such plan, that's again NP-hard. Okay? And so that will just carry over. All of that discussion carries over to this paper. Right? And so basically, the relaxed plans that Pond is computing for each initial state configuration, they're all inoptimal, but are not probably optimal. So even if you take max of them, you could, in theory, wind up being inadmissible. Remember that inadmissibility means in this entire wide world, one time the heuristic crossed the H-star, then it's inadmissible. Right? Now, why is the multiple planning graph heuristic, is it informed? So we know that it's not inadmissible. It's not admissible. Is it informed? Is it particularly informed? Informed basically means be as high as possible without crossing H star. In what ways can multiple planning graph heuristic count the distance to be less than what it really is? You talked about overcounting the distance, but can it undercount the distance? Can it underestimate the distance? Yes, and many of you pointed out, the one thing that relaxed plans don't do is negative interactions, right? And if you ignore negative interactions, then you are essentially saying, oh, this goal and this goal can be satisfied because this goal can be made in two steps, this can be made in two steps, so four steps, you'll get these two goals together. And positive interactions is going to only say that, oh, look, this one step that's common between these two, you're doing it twice, so just do it once. So instead of four steps, you only need to do three steps. So positive interactions, if you ignore, you wind up being inadmissible. But it could also be that the second step of this plan and the second step of this plan are sworn enemies. They basically, you know, one guy kills the preconditions of the other guy. In planning, being sworn enemies is that one guy kills the preconditions of the other guy. And the effects of each other, basically. So there is no ordering of them. Okay? And if there are no other plans for these goals, these are the only plans, that essentially means both of those goals cannot be done at the same time. Which means the cost is not 4 as you thought, it could be arbitrarily longer than 4. As high as infinite. So by ignoring negative interactions, these heuristics become less informed. By ignoring positive interactions, they become less admissible. Obviously, these are all, I mean, informedness is actually a matter of degree. You can't quite talk about less admissibility. It's like, you know, it's either you are admissible or you're not admissible, because if you cross one place, you're inadmissible. But, you know, you can talk about less admissible in the sense that most of the time you're still staying below. Okay. So that's the connection with the multiple planning graphs and the stuff on relaxed plans that you knew before. Other questions? I mean, I have prepared slides, but I don't need to go to them. No. Okay. So, you change the problem. When you do online, in essence, if you are, for example, in a non-ergodic domain, by doing online, it's like being a bad searcher is just being bad in your brain, you know. Being a bad online searcher is being dead, right? Because if you do the wrong thing in the world, you can actually go into a situation from which you can't come back. So I would do online not to get badges. I will do online to be lazy. This is what I mentioned last time. People do online because nothing else is possible or because they're lazy. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, online never improves guarantees. It can only worsen. Okay, I mean, these are things that you should keep in mind. I mean, you're doing online because it's too costly to do offline. And there is no way I'm allowing time for you to think, you know, I mean, I can give you 3 seconds and say start the exam. You know, if you have an infinitely powerful computer, you could do it in those 3 seconds. And if you could do it, offline computation will still be better. Okay. Anyway, so since I made you read this paper for too long, I thought I should mention that ICAP this year's best dissertation award is being given to Dan Rice. So at least I made you read a paper of somebody who's getting some kind of an award. Next one, I don't know. But, you know, so it's a series of papers that he wrote, starting from this, which is labeled uncertainty graphs, and also I mentioned about the sequential Monte Carlo heuristics. So in fact, his talk is going to be heuristics for belief space search. That's his, you know, best dissertation talk. Okay. So let me go through some of my slides, and then, you know, stop me and ask me more questions if you have questions. I'll kind of go back a little bit, and, you know, if I'm going too slow, speed me up by asking tough questions. So you could do conformant planning. Mostly I'll talk about conformant planning heuristics, even though I said heuristics for belief search planning. Why? Because, in fact, in that paper we talked about the fact that it's not all that obvious as to how to do sensing actions, how to take care of sensing actions in the search. And unfortunately, I must be dense, I still don't know the answer. So if you have good answers as to how to do sensing actions in the heuristic estimation, that's good to have. Okay? But I can tell you how the things that I think that paper talks about how that some of the things that it does can tend to be inadmissible, for example. More inadmissible than they currently already are. Okay. So if you are starting from conformant planning, which is search in the space of belief states, without any sensing, then, and you're looking for heuristics for conformant planning. Now, let's forget about Dan's paper. First, talk about how would you get heuristics. You get heuristics by relaxing the constraints of the problem. One relaxation of the constraint of the problem is to say, what do you mean you don't know the initial state? You know it. This is it. Just assume this is the completely defined initial state. That's a way of relaxing the constraint. If you do that, you will get deterministic planning. Right? And then, if you take the deterministic plan, so I would tell you, for example, that the initial state either P is true or P is false. I don't know what its value really is. I say, I don't know, really just take determinization. You know, P is true. Assume P is true. Okay? And then I will get a deterministic problem. It's a relaxation of the conformant problem. Now suppose I just solved it optimally. Forget about heuristics. Just solved it optimally. That, I would argue, is an admissible heuristic for the conformant problem. This is, you know, slightly tricky point to understand. You know, you would say, what if P being true is the bad case for you? P being false might be easier. And if P being true, you'll have a longer plan. Right? But in the conformant planning case, you have to take care of both P being true and P being false anyway. So whatever you get is going to be the lower bound on the true cost. Do you understand what I'm saying? You cannot do it by taking both determinations and adding them up. Then you start getting into trouble. Okay, just one determinization, just basically in this case determinization, in this case actually it should not be called determinization, because determinization normally means removing the probability. But in this case, basically determinization can be for action effect or init state literals. There is uncertainty about initial state literals, and if you determinize them, you remove the uncertainty and say this is the way it's going to be. By the way, in many papers, actually, it's worth thinking of the initial state itself as an arbitrary action called AI. In understanding many of these algorithms, it's worth thinking of initial state itself as an action, which has no preconditions, empty preconditions, and its effects are what is true in the initial state. So if you don't know whether P is true or not P is true, it has a non-deterministic effect. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's like a good way of just, there is really no difference between initial state uncertainty and action uncertainty. If you know how to model action uncertainty, initial state can be thought of as a dummy action. And similarly, you know that there is no difference between action preconditions and the final goal state. Because if you have a final goal state, the preconditions of the final goal state really, I mean, you can think of the final goal state as a dummy action, which has only one effect saying done. You're done, go home, okay? And its preconditions are what must be true before you're done. So it's kind of useful to think of initial state and goal state sometimes as dummy actions. Initial state only with effects, goal state only with preconditions. Okay? So this you should understand. And anytime you solve a harder problem, the easier problem becomes the relaxation for the harder problem. And so whatever work you did now is a heuristic. So how does that make you feel? You know, if you learned all about classical planning, at least you're providing useful heuristics for the real problem, conformant planning. Okay? And so that's very much reasonable way of doing relaxation. So having said this, now you should ask yourself, if I did it that way, then I would be coming closer to FF Hopp idea, which you haven't read, but you know I mentioned a little bit, that I made a determinization and solved that determinization optimally. If I solved it inoptimally, God help me again, because admissibility is gone. Okay? And we know that we don't solve anything optimally. It's nice to talk about our optimality, but you know you don't really solve them optimally, because the deterministic planner you use would be something like FF, which uses relaxed plan heuristic, which is inadmissible. Right? But again, as I said, the difference between computer scientist and a hacker is one knows what optimality is, how hard it is to get, and gives up willingly. And the hacker says, who the heck cares? You know, I just write the program, go home, and I have a life. Okay, so that's one idea you should think of. And it's, as I speak today, by the way, it's not obvious to me that this idea would be particularly worse compared to Dan's idea. I don't know, okay, because I also have bet on FF Hopp, which works well too, and you will see that for stochastic planning. And so it's like there are two different ways of relaxing the problems, and which one works better is not too obvious to me, okay? Yes?
One question. You tested numerical data, that is in the study. You tested on several domains of the problem. we know that ultimately this boils down, every plant solves a search problem at its lowest level. And remember when you in 471 you mentioned that there is a very thin band of hard problems. So, you are actually generating very specific
problems.
How can you actually compare?
I say, first of all, that's an excellent point. Okay, that's an excellent point. And what the point he's making is that if you make your own problems up, sometimes the problems might be either, you know, unnaturally easy or unnaturally harder than the real problems. Now, unnaturally easy or harder than the real hard problems. The good point, of course, is who cares about the real hard problems? I mean, unless you're a masochist, you don't need the real hard problems unless you encounter them in the dead of the night and you have to solve them. Okay? These are benchmarks, okay, that somebody made. Now, the interesting question, so this is actually a pretty classic point, and let me just put a couple of minutes on that, because planning research suffers from it, so does large amount of empirical research in, you know, related to search. Okay? So what should a search algorithm be evaluated on? How do you evaluate search algorithms? Focus on random problems. Of course, you can also do worst case analysis. Worst case complexity analysis. The problem with worst case complexity analysis is you do it once and you stop doing AI. Right? Because there is no problem in AI that's not at least NP-hard. If it's not at least NP-hard, we probably won't bother about them. I mean, it's not that we are masochists, but every interesting problem seems to be hard. Okay, so it's useful to know what is the worst case complexity just so that on the off chance you are not providing an exponential algorithm for a polynomial problem. You know, so that's the only reason to know the worst case complexity. Otherwise, it's not really useful. Okay, a related version, of course, is average case complexity. Now, the problem about average case complexity is that how to define average case depends basically on the same sort of issues that we talk about in empirical evaluation. Average over who? Average over what distribution? Okay? So now, then you can talk about empirical. How bad it is, worst case. I mean, the state of the art normally is people look at what's the worst case and realize that at least we are still in AI, we are not polynomial time, the database guys don't have to be called in. And then you start trying to solve the problem using, you know, reasonable heuristic techniques and try to provide guarantees where you can, knowing that you don't expect worst case scenarios for it to be solvable, right? Now, solvable meaning solvable in polynomial time. Okay, now in doing it empirically, you can do focus on random problems, just generate problems randomly. Generate an action name and its effects and preconditions randomly. Generate an initial state randomly. Generate a goal state randomly. This is sort of, for those of you who remember the SAT discussions that we had, which is what your question is coming from, is what people in SAT did. You know, they would generate random SAT problems and essentially found that random SAT problems are too darn easy to solve, even though the SAT worst case complexity is NP-hard. Okay, then you can, in this, a small subset of this is generate hard random problems and solve them. It's worth doing. And in fact, I made a big deal about it in Intro to AI, that there is, for 3SAT, there is this magic number, which is number of classes by number of variables. When it approaches a magic number, which is about 4.3 something, that's exactly when basically the probability that the problem is satisfiable is exactly 50%. That's the hardest problems to solve in satisfiability. If it is highly probable that it's unsatisfiable, you're likely to find that it's unsatisfiable very quickly. You'll find a small proof that it's unsatisfiable. If it's highly satisfiable, you're likely to find a satisfying assignment very easily too. It's exactly in this middle where you can't be sure until you try everything that you're dead, right? And so, and what's interesting, of course, is the random problems live in a narrow neighborhood. There is work, since you got this up, there is work by a guy called Rintanen, which tries to do this I hope somebody is taking this down. I want to put a slide on this once I'm done, since I'm discussing this, which tries to do this for planning problems. Okay, the results are not as elegant as SAT problems, but there he also shows that there does exist some sort of a threshold. No, you can find a threshold. I mean, there's a sharp threshold. But my issue is not that. My issue is this reasonable thing to do? Why should I care about hard random problems? Okay, all that matters is the hard test problems that Rao is going to give me on my midterm. Do you understand what I'm saying? So really the other possibility is random have nothing to do with real. Get real problems and solve them. So one of the classic points about this is, how many of you have heard about simplex algorithm for solving linear programming? Okay, that's the algorithm that everybody used for the longest time. Even now many of them use, airline scheduling, etc., etc. Simplex is an essentially exponential algorithm. Okay, so OR should have just stopped working and gone home long back. But they found that for the kind of problems that they need to solve, for the size of problems that you need to solve, they were able to get by, And as the machine speed increases, as long as I keep you happy. So suppose there is nobody who needs to stack 4,000 blocks on top of each other, and you can only stack 100 blocks right now, you don't have to be depressed, because very few people are interested in stacking more than 100 blocks. Okay, so this is like the practical horizon of any particular search problems, and if people aren't asking for it, you don't need to. And if you are Bill Gates, you can tell people what to ask for and say nobody needs more than 640K of memory. You shouldn't be doing anything, that requires more than 640K. But, obviously this real keeps changing, because at one time Microsoft can get by with 640K of memory, but now its damn operating system doesn't fit, even if you give it multi-gigabyte disk and memory, right? So this is one thing to do, and this is one type and this one. Now the problem with the real is, at least your boss is happy, why do you care? The other, of course, is that for different real problems have different viewpoint, different real problems have different characteristics, and so your results in a specific real problem may not at all have any impact on anybody else's real problem. What that means is you can't write a paper, first point. Which means, in fact, some of the most boring papers are ones where people stand up and, at the time when AI was going through this whole expert systems revolution for a while back, back in the late 80s, everybody would write an expert system for a particular domain. And then they'll just stand up and in a 30-minute talk, describe their domain for 29 minutes, and in the last minute and say, we also use expert systems to solve it. That can get boring, because you're not learning anything more than those domains. Okay, it'll get you jobs. In fact, what's good for conferences and what's good for jobs, worker ants are completely different things. Worker ants need the same thing being done multiple times so that, you can have a job. Okay, whereas from a scientific point of view, we want to know where does this break, so that we can do something else. Okay, so get real problems and solutions is an interesting, and solve them is a very interesting way of doing empirical evaluation, except it has its own problems, because your real problem might be very different from somebody else's real problem. So in fact, a very interesting point is that you'd say NASA's planning problems must be some of the hardest planning problems, right? I hope you'd say that, okay? Now it turns out that there's a paper which basically shows that a particular kind of planning problem that was being solved in the context of the rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, winds up being actually much simpler than the simplest ship planning problems, because the domain has a certain characteristic which makes it easy to solve. It's great for them, and it's great that they took time to evaluate it and say, why were we faster than the negative results in planning community? But that particular property doesn't hold in any other domain. So what do you do then? Okay. And a third one is benchmarks. benchmarks essentially can be thought of as everybody's real world problem is sort of in some sense abstracted and made into a particular benchmark. And then if you have a suite of benchmarks, and if everybody's planner or search algorithm is tried on all the suite of benchmarks, which this suite is continually expanding, then you'll hopefully know not only how well a planner or a search algorithm or a SAT solver does in a particular suite, a particular class of problems, but also how does it do across the suite.
You have a real world problem, you have to know how that maps on with.
That's a good point. Yeah. So now of course the issue is, where are these benchmarks coming from? In the best of all worlds, the benchmarks would come from completed real world problems. But since it's research, oftentimes that may not happen that way. Nobody has already completed applying a specific technique to a specific real world problem. So somebody goes, understands the problem, and writes a benchmark which sort of removes some of the detail but keeps what they think are the important details. And whenever you do this, and this happens in science all the time, right? And whenever you do it, you have to be careful. You have to every once in a while check whether or not the benchmarks are reasonable. Okay, I'll tell you, so planning work of late has been very much benchmark driven. And I can tell you at least two things that are wrong about that. Every one of these has problems. It's just you have to know which one, has what problems, that's it. So, for example, one idea that I wonder once in a while is planning benchmarks are all in domains which are ergodic. Very few benchmark domains. I'm telling this to you guys, and you haven't really figured out what are all the planning benchmarks according to the community. There is every 2 years a planning competition where there's a whole bunch of new domains that are added to the growing list of domains. And every planner, if you have, God forbid, a new idea in classical planning, you have to then, compare it to every planner on every domain. And then you will say, I've done better than the other people. So don't have good ideas in classical planning. Have it in these other ones that I'm talking about, the belief space planning and sequential Monte Carlo, right? That's a good way. But anyway, it turns out that most of these domains tend to be having this property that they're ergodic. Because of which certain kinds of search strategies always seem to do well. And Jörg Hoffman has a very nice paper on why FF works so well. And he says essentially that most benchmarks have this very interesting property. It's not that people put it on purpose, but they seem to have that. Now, that also explains, for example, something that we mentioned in this class in passing, and definitely more last time, which is that progression planners seem to be doing better than regression planners, even though you would think regression planners should do better than progression planners. Okay? Now, progression, and one reason that can be, if in fact, one idea for that could be that if you just completely randomly picked a domain from the world, the chances that you would get stuck coming back in search are about the same as the chances that you get stuck going forward. But in all the benchmark domains, you never get stuck in any state. If you are in a state, you can always get out of that state to some other state. Okay? So the benchmarks might, for example, influence which planners are doing better than which other planners. Not surprisingly. Okay? And then one other line of work that I might get to a little later is that there was this, all benchmarks might wind up, for example, there is a class of planning problems called temporal planning problems, which take the duration of actions into account. And basically, somebody, including some people at ASU, have shown that all those benchmarks essentially call themselves temporal planning problems, but you can ignore time in them. So they really are classical planning problems, which call themselves temporal planning problems. And so you are talking about domains where they're considered temporal planning domains. That means they think action duration is important. But it turns out that you can ignore durations up front, do planning without the durations, and then post-process the plan to include the durations in, and you do just as fine. If that's the case, then people who are thinking that they're doing good work in temporal planning might be mistaken because they're looking at the wrong benchmark. Now, having said all this, it turns out that the benchmarks for the problems we are talking about, the belief search planning and the stochastic planning, they are essentially in dark ages compared to even benchmarks for classical planning. In the sense, you know, if you have about 100 benchmarks, then you can argue and say, are they good ones, bad ones, are they biased? If you have two, you just solve them. Right? So again, that's the point of, it's not an undergraduate class. I'm telling you, whatever I can take, essentially, I can tell you what's going well, what's not going well. And tomorrow, if you ask me, I'll be more depressed about the things that I thought were going well today. But that's the way it is. If you are at the edge, that's the way it is. Okay? But you should ask yourself these questions and, you know, make connections. This is a big point about empirical research in general, and it's true for, you know, large number of cases. So, for example, sometimes this winds up working in your favor. Naive-based classifiers are like the worst possible machine learning algorithms. Nobody would even think about them when everything was based on benchmark-based research. And then it turned out that they were pretty good for the kind of massive data spaces that, you know, and the text classification that you wind up doing, partly because you need to be only as good as your competitor and epsilon more. And the competitors weren't doing all that well anyway. Okay? Okay, so in this case, you could do conformance planning or you could do dance stuff, which we will go through quickly. But this basically is this point, you know, this slide basically points out all the points that Dan was making as to when you're talking about distances between belief states and another belief state, there are all sorts of issues you have to take into account. How many states are there in each belief state? How far are each of the states from the goal? How much interaction is there between the states? And the one point I want you to think about is that those of you who remember classical planning, we used to do almost this kind of a discussion. And except I would say, how big are each state? How many literals are there in the state? And how much interaction is there between literals? How does making this goal true affect this other goal being true? The interactions were being discussed in classical planning too, except they were between literals. Now the interactions are between states, which are conjunctions of literals. So it adds one more layer of complexity that you have to worry about. Okay. And then, so in fact, if you have any intuitions at all about how the negative interactions were making you unhappy in classical planning, all those intuitions will work in conformance planning if you just replace the word literal with the word state. That's the point of that. Okay? So yeah, in addition to the interaction between literals, as in classical planning, all the problems for classical planning are still there, right below the hood, because the plan for a single world is a classical plan. But you want a plan that works in all worlds, not just one world, without knowing which world you are in. That's what conformance planning is. Okay? And so how many, I think I mentioned, some of you know this, right? Which is the world's funniest joke, the USA version, which is very relevant to the classical, you know, conformance planning. And so the joke goes like this. So somebody calls 911, and you know, he's saying, oh my God, my friend just, you know, stopped breathing. I think he's dead. You know, they're on some sort of a hike. And so this lady on the 911 says, sir, calm down, calm down. First, you want to make sure whether your friend is dead. And so then he says, sure, wait, wait, wait. And then, you know, he goes off from the phone. There's a big bang. Then he comes back and says, yes. Right? So that's conformance planning. Essentially, he reduced the uncertainty in the world. And so now they can send a mortuary van. But anyway, we do have, if you avoid sensing, you know, you force the world. This is, by the way, I mean, BBC many years back had like an online poll, before online polls became particularly popular, as to what's the funniest joke. And a different joke was the funniest joke in the world over. This is the one that's funniest in US. We have this gun culture. So, you know, something has to have guns in it. Okay. Okay, so belief state. One, so of the many things here, one of them is how many states are there in the belief state. The other is how far are they from the goal state. And you need to reduce both. You need to reduce the cardinality, but you also need to reduce the distance. And what much of the earlier parts of Dan Saper was saying is that earlier work before him mostly focused on cardinality reduction, which is a reasonable thing to do in some really hard, uncertain domains, where if you do not reduce cardinality, you can't make any progress whatsoever. And the classic canonical example for that is when you wake up in the middle of the night, you look for a wall, and then you, you know, you follow the wall. Okay? But you can't just do one or the other. If you always try to reduce the uncertainty, you reduce the uncertainty here. But that was a bad way of reducing the uncertainty. After the uncertainty was reduced, the goal just became infinitely far away. Assuming that this guy wanted to save his friend, we never know. Okay. So not only cardinality, you also want to look at the distances. So now, for happy slides, happy animated slides. One interesting thing about Dan Rice, who used to be a student here, is the guy was good with animations. I don't know, maybe you guys are too, but my animation sucked. Everything which was too easy were made by me, and anything which actually looks impressive was made by him. These were his slides, you know, at some point of time. And the later versions of his animations are even more complex. So if you, by mistake, see them in the normal PowerPoint version, you can't understand a thing, because there are like 10,000 things on the same slide, because they'll come at different times. But if you see it this way, they're actually quite useful. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, suppose I have this little problem, okay? I have the actions there, and this is the same problem we had. One of P or Q or R is true, okay? And you want to get to goal G, and then M gives the action A1, if M is true, then it gives K if P is true. And A2 gives K if Q is true. A3 gives L if R is true. And K gives G and L gives G. Okay? So the interesting point is you should know how to solve this problem first, right? And the way you solve this problem is, if you do A1, A2, A3, then you will definitely be in K and L. You will either have K or L. And these two actions then will get you, whether you're in K or L, to G. Okay? Let me stop this annoying slide forwarding, if I can remember how to do that. Okay. So you basically have a situation where P and M in the initial state really is one of these three states. It's a simple enough problem that you can think in terms of individual states. P and M, Q and M, and R and M. Okay? Now, the simplest idea is to sample and just pick one determinization. So just say, oh, PM is what I really have, and then solve the problem. That would be that idea that I mentioned earlier. That would be just a single determinization, and you solve the problem for that using classical planning. Either you get the estimate or the real value, they both will be lower bounds on the conformant plan. Okay, he doesn't do that. His first idea was just remove the boundaries between states, so that it's one proposition list. In planning graph terminology, it's a very reasonable syntactic thing to do. If you remember planning graph for classical planning starts with an initial state, which is a real state, and right after that, everything is a proposition list. It's just a union of states. So why should it be that the first one should be non-proposition list? So all I did right now is I made even the first one proposition list. So normally in planning graph, you know that if you are looking for a list, you know, a state, you know, where P and Q are true, if the current proposition list contains P and Q, I mean it doesn't contain P and Q, or just contains only one of them, then you know for sure that PQ together is not possible by that level. If it is there, then you know it's a lower bound. The index of that level is the lower bound on how long the plan needs to be. Okay, I'm just doing this for the initial state too. This too is a proposition list, and really every state, every real state is a subset of this. Okay, so all your intuitions about what happens when you do proposition list in planning graph should make sense here too. Now the advantage of this is now nothing needs to change. I just construct the planning graph. If you think about it, the way planning graphs are constructed, you don't really care that the initial state is a complete state. It just happened to be that way, but you never really used it. All you needed was put actions and put their effects in the next level. Right? That's what I did here. So I have a single planning graph. Okay? And then once I have a single planning graph, I can compute the relaxed plan. So I start from G, and that's one relaxed plan. In fact, I think that's pretty much I could have had another relaxed plan, right? I could have had this as a relaxed plan, for example. I just got one relaxed plan. And so I count the number of actions in the relaxed plan. Heuristic estimate is 2. Okay. Actually, if you are adventurous, you should try to compare this with the determinization approach. and see a single determinization approach and see whether there is a connection between the distances you get in those ways. Okay, so that's the simplest idea. Now obviously this is going to be less informed because you know it makes the problem much easier than what it really is. Okay, so the next idea, so it's a minimal implementation for this heuristic, but then it's not particularly effective, and because you're mixing up the worlds, you are thinking, oh, I can do this because if I'm in that world, I can do this. But I can do this because I'm in this world, but you're only in one of the two worlds. Okay, really what you need to do is you need to compute the mutexes between these actions. Just as propositionalists have mutexes, if you want to do this slightly better with negative interactions, the idea you would do is you would say P and R are negatively interacting, Q and M are negatively interacting, and so on. So if you go back, everything in this is negatively interacting with everything in this. Of course, a particular literal cannot negatively interact with itself, so P is negatively interacting with Q, P is negatively interacting with R. And if you throw those in and you do planning graph-based mutex propagation, you'll get a better effect, for example. Okay. The next idea is keep the worlds separate, so don't combine them, and try to reason with each of them separately, which is the multiple planning graph idea. And you know, basically what you did was you constructed a planning graph for each of these worlds, and you computed the relaxed plan in each of the worlds, and you aligned them correctly, avoided counting the repeated actions, and took the number of actions. Okay, that's the multiple planning graph. So in this particular case, so A1, A2, A3, A4 only is counted once because A4 is coming here again, and A5 is coming here. Okay, now this is where that alignment point comes that somebody else was making. In this case, the example is simple enough that they are about the same length, and you did not have to worry whether or not you are aligning them correctly. Okay, what if this guy had A2, A4, you know, this world had an A2, A4 suffix, but it wound up starting with two extra actions which really are not going anywhere, which is completely feasible given that you are doing relaxed plan and they are not optimal. You can have non-minimal actions in the plan. Then if you don't align them correctly, you would multiply count some actions. And equivalently, you can do the opposite. You know, A4 coming before is different from A4 coming after, depending on how the interactions work. So it's ultimately it's just a heuristic idea. Okay, and the alignment, specific details of the alignment that Dan does, you should look up. But he doesn't spend too much CPU cycles on that.
You said that they don't align them because of some interaction issues?
No, he completely ignores interaction issues. But I'm saying is, as to what is the right alignment also depends on the interaction, which you are ignoring here. Okay? So this is, now what you wind up doing in this case is that you are basically uniting the graph and avoiding counting some of the actions that are being repeated. Okay? And it turns out, I forget where it went, but there should be, something is missing in that previous slide. But the total number here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? 6 actions. No, I'm sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 actions. In this little problem, you know that the actual optimal plan is 5 actions long. So you know that this heuristic for this particular case was H star. I mean, this is not a proof that it will always be H star, but in this case, at least it lucked out and got the actual optimal distance. Whereas this previous guy didn't even get it in this easy case. He got it 2. 2 is like much lower. Okay, 5, you know, basically at least is coming closer to the true cost. Okay, now, so as I said in my discussion preceding this, if you are ignoring negative interactions, modulo the question of the right way of aligning sequences, right way of aligning plans, this is as good as you can get. In this particular problem, it turns out that the good as you can get is actually the optimal cost. But some other cases, it would not be. It could be arbitrarily far away from both, from optimum, because optimum will be infinitely long, for example. Okay? So if you are not doing negative interactions, this is pretty much as good as you can get. Okay? And the question then is, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with it is, here there are three states. Sometimes you can actually have exponential number of states. And furthermore, I cheated. None of you asked me as to why, where I'm cheating. What am I cheating? Even if I said confinement planning, there's something funny about this problem. No, what made me make it a deterministic problem?
Because it shows one thing only and
you have No, I did not. So, the question is, I took each action here and here and here. Okay? But I basically messed around at the time when I started with the example. What's interesting about those examples, that particular action?
Actions that might be inapplicable.
No, they're all deterministic. They're not non-deterministic. They're all deterministic actions. Basically belief space planning doesn't have to be for only initial state uncertainty. Remember, you should also be able to deal with non-deterministic actions. What becomes a big problem if you have non-deterministic actions is you need to not only do this, you need to determinize over action outcomes. So, first of all, even if you have deterministic actions and initial state uncertainty, there could be a large number of initial states you have to plan over. And B, if you have non-deterministic actions, then all hell breaks loose and you have even more number of worlds to plan over. Okay? And the problem about this multiple planning graph approach really is that it is trying to do this aggregation. It's trying to look exhaustively over all the worlds. There is work in that paper which talks about sampling the world. But the problem with there is, unless I have a good distribution information on which is likely, sampling assumes just uniform distribution, so it's not particularly going to get me too much. In this paper, he just basically samples too. He has a part on sampling. But for non-determinism, sampling makes no sense. If you have distribution information, if you are stochastic, then the right thing to do is sample the world. And that's what the next paper, that thankfully you don't have to read, but you may want to read. It's only another 65 pages, called Sequential Monte Carlo Heuristics for Stochastic Planning. I'll send you a link. I'll assume that as soon as I send you a link, you read it right away. Stop everything you're doing. That's how I'll set up my exams and all that, under that assumption. Okay. So the point is that there are too many worlds to work over. As nice as this animation looks, at least to my eyes, there are too many worlds to work over. So the idea is somehow, one other point at the risk of going back is, there is enough of repetition between the worlds. The structure of the worlds are, it's not that each of these worlds are completely different from the other worlds. Maybe a couple of state variables wind up having different values in each of the worlds. That may or may not make huge differences in the relaxed plan. What's the worst case for you? The worst case for you is that all these relaxed plans are pretty much the same, and you look like a total fool having recomputed it only a billion times. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if there is repetition and you don't exploit it, you are not a computer scientist. Dynamic programming is an example. If you have repetition and you don't exploit it, you die. Okay? So in this case, we try to exploit the repetition by not recomputing planning graphs. And instead, what you will try to do is let the planning graph literals stay as they are, but you add to each of them labels. And these labels, you can think of here in terms of colors for now, okay, as to how did you get here. So for example, P came because an action working in this yellow state got a P. So P is yellow. Q came because an action working in the green state gave you Q. So Q is green. And then R is red. Okay, M actually is coming from all three. Really, its label should be, even though it's made white here, it should really be yellow, green, and red. yellow, green, and red really is having white, because in this particular case, if you're true in all words, that means you're true, period. Okay? Now, the label can be thought of as, here is the planning graph, and if you give me the world you are in, I'll tell you which part of this planning graph actually exists for you. Remember, I mean, if you buy any of these Apple things or any of these electronic things, they'll send you a huge big manual, and you open the manual, you realize that actually your iPod Touch is supposed to do all these great things, and then the fine print says, if you happen to have 8GB model, you just go to the last page and see that you can only switch it on and off. And all the other things, we put it for the people who bought the 32GB model. It's the same model, labeled manual. So the label, once I know, I look at my label and say, oh, I'm an 8GB guy. So just skip, go and, you know, do the few things I can do. Okay? So one single planning graph here can tell me, depending on the label of the world the set of worlds I'm living in, I can, you know, conjoin it with the planning graph to get the real planning graph I am living in. That's the way to think about it. Okay. So now continuing the color analogy, so P will then get me A1, Q A2, R A3, M, you know, you can think of it as yellow, green, red, but, you know, it's also white, in the sense that all of them are there. Okay. I continue here, and notice by the time you come here, K is supported both by A1 and by A2. You always knew, even when you were doing classical planning, that there is something problematic about planning graphs. They don't seem to differentiate between an action which is being supported by 15 guys and an action which is being supported barely by one guy. Now you can, if they are from different worlds. So in essence, what you're saying is, unlike R, which is only true in the red world, and if you are in the red world, R can be expected to be here, K would be there if you are in either green or blue world. And L will be, and so that's that much you know. Yes, sir.
Are you going to display nemesis actions?
What nemesis actions? The negative interactions.
Yeah.
We don't do negative interactions. None of these do negative interactions right now. That appendix is the thing about negative interactions, and it's hugely headache inducing. And I know that a lot of you wanted to take the negative interactions into account. About the only thing I can say is actually it's been done, and it doesn't pay for its cost of detecting the negative interactions. A heuristic, you don't want to do more than is actually useful. At least the ideas that were tried weren't good enough, that the time spent in computing the heuristic didn't materialize in terms of the improved search. Heuristic did become more informed, of course. But, you know, you can get perfect heuristic by solving the problem and using the cost of the problem solved as a heuristic for the real problem. That's completely useless, right? Okay, so, and then K, now by the time you come here, anything K is supporting now will automatically get its all the worlds that it supported. Okay, so in this particular case, so P A1, Q A2, R is supporting A3, and K is supporting A4, so really it should be blue and not yellow and green, it should be blue and green. Okay? Because A4 is only supported by K. Okay? Now, you can also see that if in fact, if A4 winds up requiring two preconditions, if A4 winds up requiring two preconditions, then the label for it would be the conjunction of the labels of the preconditions. Now, you know, enough of this color nonsense. Actually, all the colors are logical formulas. Colors are good to look at, but really what we are doing is, this world, you can say that its label, the yellow label, is not Q and not R. If not Q and not R is true, that's the world you would be in. And the green label is not P and not R, and red label is not P and not Q. And the new labels are constructed by, if there is an action which is taking multiple labeled preconditions, you take the conjunction of the labels. If a proposition is getting support from multiple labels, you take the disjunction of those formulas. In this little example itself, by the time you come to, you know, here red, blue, and green, the formula starts looking like that, which is why the formula is not being shown in the picture. Which is actually why Dan points out that you need to be able to deal with these labels, you need to have efficient methods for handling large logical formulas and very quickly take a logical formula corresponding to the world you think you are in and conjoining them with these large formulas and specializing it to tell you which worlds you actually are in. And those are done in BDDs, binary decision diagrams. Okay? So in this case, the advantage is that finally, by the time I came here to G is being supported by A4, so it gets green and blue, and supported by A5, so it gets red. And if you get all three, that means you have the full support. So you can stop expanding the graph here. Okay? Now, having stopped expanding the graph, now I'll start talking about relaxed plan. Now, in the case of relaxed plan, previously you would just pick somebody, one action would have been enough. You know, if G is being supported by two actions, you'll pick any one of them. Right now, you need to pick enough actions such that you have the strongest support. Strongest, in the best case, is all worlds. Okay? So you'd wind up having to pick A4 because you'll get blue and green, and A5 because you'll get red. That's when you have the full support. So now the relaxed plan wind up having additional support. One is needed for one world, another is needed for the other. In fact, this one is needed for two of the worlds. This one is needed, if God forbid, you're in the third world. Okay? The same idea of relaxed plan, now you do multiple supports. Okay? This idea can actually be extended when you have probabilities. As you increase the number of actions supporting something, you tend to, if you are doing it right, increase the probability of that thing being true. Right? I mean, if I have to close my eye and start trying to hit the nail into the wall, right, I can do one and just stop, or do 58 times and then, you know, stop at that point and know for sure that either the nail went in or there's a hole in the wall. Either way, I would have been made, I increased the probability that the hole went in. Right? Okay. So I pick these two actions. Now, for both of these actions, I get the preconditions at the previous level. I support all those preconditions again in the recursive way. They should be supported in all the worlds they are needed, not more. Okay? So for example, it turns out that K need only to be supported in the two worlds that A4 is using it. It doesn't have to be supported in over all the worlds. So you can reduce the amount of support needed as you go back. That's another thing that he does in the algorithm. Okay? So that you won't do unnecessary work. Okay? That's basically your relaxed plan in green, and in this particular case, the heuristic value is 5. And you did not compute multiple planning graphs, you just computed one, and you wound up keeping labels. The advantage of this idea is if there is repetition, and if all planning graphs are the same, you'll get one single planning graph. If in fact all planning graphs are completely different, they are disjoint, then it would be as bad as doing all multiple graphs. But that's what any idea that tries to avoid repetition does. Dynamic programming can be just as bad as not doing any dynamic programming when there is no recursion, no repetition to take care of. Okay? So that's the LUG, that's the labeled uncertainty graph idea. Okay? So we will stop here, and this one I actually sort of mentioned. You can try to handle mutexes. The major problem becomes mutexes can exist both in the same world, as in classical planning, or across different worlds. Basically, I can't say I have P because, oh, I think I'm in this world, so I'll get P here, and then I have Q because, oh, I think I'm in this world, so I'll get Q here. Now P and Q are no longer together. Furthermore, an action you do in one world can cause an interaction in the second world. So for example, in that Medicaid domain, right? If you medicate thinking, oh, this guy has, I'm in the world where this guy has the disease, then it will kill him in the domain where he doesn't have the, in the world where he doesn't have the disease. And you need to deal with the mutexes, you need to separate the worlds out. Okay? It can be done, but, you know, I think all I can say is in that particular paper, I think the better ideas are needed to do it right. On that particular paper, the way it was done didn't increase the performance. Okay, I will stop here. I was actually going to also talk a little bit about BDDs, but I might do it next class in the beginning, and then mainly next class we'll be doing Markov decision processes, which falls one level below in terms of expressiveness, do atomic. Okay, look at the slides before coming.